Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
How's it going, Derek?
Going good. We got some extra echo in here, don't we?
Right? Big ceilings.
We're in a bigger
big
studio.
Room. This is the most expensive looking studio I've ever recorded in. This is awesome. So we're on the road.
Yeah.
On the road this week. And
interviewing on location.
On location, eh?
Bob Cajun.
Wow. Bob Cajun. Last time I was in Bob Cajun, I could see the constellations. They appeared one at a time.
That's a
sorry.
Song.
Sorry. Tragically, yep. Got to do it. We are actually up here because we were told there was somebody coming through doing the Great Loop. Peter Frank.
Hello.
How you doing, buddy?
Oh, my gosh. Doing amazing.
Good to be here, eh?
It's really great to be here. I feel pretty welcomed.
Well, it's nice after you've been doing the Great Loop here for a couple of months now, and you get out, instead of actually having to bathe in the water, you actually get a shower.
Yeah.
You get some food, some nice hot food, nice relaxing seats to sit in. Oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
I think I'm just going to move in here.
Chunks of wood to bark his toes off of.
Oh, don't even get me started. Don't even get me started on stubbing toes. So, Peter, we heard you're doing the Great Loop, so we decided we would come up here and sit down with you and record an interview with you and about who you are. And I found out you're doing more than just the Great Loop.
I am.
This started way back in about 2021 originally, but it even starts before then. So the unicycle expedition. Tell us about the
take
unicycle.
Take us back to the start.
Take us way. We're getting right into this, buddy.
Hot tub time machine.
Back in the bittery waters of the 1800s. Okay. The sea was a mistress. So, unicycling. Man, I loved unicycling. Gosh. I loved it so much that I ended up going across the country with it. I had a lot of people that inspired me to do that, though. But I learned from my brother when I was 11, actually, very young. And as I get older, I'm meeting a lot of people that are getting into it themselves at young ages. And it's a fun thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's also a girl magnet. If you're ever out of luck, so.
Right?
They just pick up a wheel or a half a bicycle and you're good to go.
I think that's how Derek got his wife.
Maybe. No, it was through kayaking.
Yeah, so I learned how to ride a unicycle when I was 11 years old, and it turned into one of my favorite things to do on the entire planet. I mean, like, I rode a unicycle every day.
And wow.
It was all the time. I ended up signing up for parades and doing all sorts of community events around my town where I would, like, to have the unicycle. Sometimes I'd dress like a clown, and my brother did that, too, 15 years ago when he was my age.
Right.
Yeah, so I learned a lot of that from him. And it ended up becoming this staple in my routine. And I know this is a paddling.
Oh yeah, that's fine.
It's a paddling podcast, but to tell you the truth, I would have never found paddling if it weren't for unicycling. And the story of that was that I had gotten run over by a car at 14 years old. Not from unicycling.
I was going to ask.
If you had two wheels.
if I could bike it. But no, I had this catastrophic thing happen to me at this young age. And this is long before I had any kind of self-awareness in my life. I didn't really understand what life was about. Nobody really does when they're that age. I still don't. But I had gotten run over by a car. I shattered my L1 and L2 vertebrae on my spine. I ended up with 3 titanium rods in my body.
Oh, wow.
And spent about a month and a half in the hospital.
Right. At the age of 14.
At the age of 14. But the entire recovery was a year and a half with physical therapy. I had months in a wheelchair and had one of those granny walkers.
Oh, okay.
They wanted to give me a cane, but I very much insisted that it was a granny walker. I thought it would be funnier. You know. So I was airlifted to a hospital in Marquette, Michigan, which was an hour away from where it had happened. And there I spent a month and a half. And, you know, I had a back surgeon and a separate leg surgeon. and broke three ribs, my scapula, nose, like I said, L1 and L2 vertebrae, and my right femur. And while I was recovering in the hospital, one of the things that I had asked, not particularly my doctor, but I had asked the nurses to relay a message to the doctor, was that I wanted to be able to ride a unicycle again. It was really important to me to get back on it as soon as possible. I didn't understand this thing that had happened. And the message that I had gotten back was, unicycling is such a dangerous activity that if I relearn how to walk after being in a wheelchair and going through all this physical stuff and I get all these limitations lifted after years of this therapy, then unicycling would just be so unlikely that you just don't have high hopes for it. So
right.
It had broken me. Like, I was 14 years old.
No.
I was shattered. My dreams were just had fallen apart. And I didn't know how to feel. I really didn't. I think a lot of that I internalized and for a long period of time, because a lot of my childhood was taken from me because of that event, as you could imagine.
Oh, yeah.
I had a lot of restrictions. I had a 40-pound weight limit for lifting anything.
Ooh.
They said that it was for the rest of my life, but I mean, look at what I'm doing now.
Right.
And after that, I went through a lot of other things. I was in Boy Scouts at the time. I became an Eagle Scout when I was 17. I was homeless for 4 months when I was 17 as well. And I had a lot of pivotal points in my experience on Earth. But after everything, like trying to grow up with those limitations, I turned 19 years old and I felt like this calling that was so beyond myself that I didn't fully understand yet. And it's really interesting to have something like that, especially at a young age, call you to just embark on something.
Yeah.
And I didn't know why. So I sold everything I had. I didn't feel like I needed it anymore. And I talked to my parents about it. I talked to everybody about it. I was motivated and inspired by people like Ed Pratt, for example. He's the man who unicycled around the entire planet over 3.5 years from 2015 to 2018. There's a number of other people, Kerry Gray and a lot of other adventurers that I had been following online or had heard of from books and stories. And, you know, as any young man would be inspired and a little bit crazy to do, I took what pooled money I have from everything that I sold and I purchased a 36-inch mountain unicycle. And I rigged it up with my brother, everything that I thought I would need for however long I would be out there. And I rode it 2,400 miles across the United States. And in the process, I raised $34,000 for a charity organization that had given a place for my family to stay while I was recovering in the hospital so many years ago,
right,
which was the Beacon House organization.
Cool. A mountain unicycle.
You
out of the entire story, that's all I... there's a mountain unicycle?
Yeah, I got to watch the YouTube videos. There's
you wouldn't believe it exists.
There's people that do mountain biking, rock jumping, uphill, downhill. It's like... you're doing that on a unicycle? That's crazy.
Really?
Oh, yeah. This is some serious stuff.
See, you're watching totally different videos than I'm watching. I mean, that's quite obvious.
It's amazing.
You wouldn't believe it exists until you see it in person. The thing is enormous. I mean, it took me a kick and a jump just to get on it every time.
Really? Wow. So your unicycle expedition went June 28th, 2021. To October 5th, 2021.
Yeah, 99 days.
Appleton, Wisconsin to Phoenix, Arizona.
Yeah.
You were doing that. Like you say, 99 days, 2,400 miles or 3,860 kilometers. Raising money for Beacon House, which is pretty cool. Solo and unsupported, and you were 19 years old.
I left with $600 in my pocket. it was pretty rough.
Right?
But I did it thanks to a lot of support from family members and people that I had met along the way. I was given numerous places to stay by strangers that I was meeting just on the roadways or
right.
different yeah. towns. And if it wasn't for them, I definitely would not have made it.
Because we saw that guy when we were driving out west, Canada's 150th. That was 2000 and I always want to say 16. Was it 18?
1867. So it's going to be a 7.
17. So I can never remember these. I don't remember my birthday some days. When we were heading out west, driving from Ontario to Alberta, there was a guy doing cross Canada on a unicycle, and we're just driving along, and also my daughter, look, there's a guy.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It was like, that's him.
Yeah, who is he?
Yeah, I don't know who it was, but it was, yeah, he's riding a unicycle across Canada.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty crazy thing to witness. And
right?
That's coming from somebody who did it.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Oh, I wish you could have met him.
So from there, and a lot of people said, oh, I'm going to do another trip next year. Maybe I'll do one in 2 years or something like that. No, you, backpacking expedition, November 11th, 2021. So this is like a month.
So you took a few weeks off in Phoenix and then continued on with backpacking.
To Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's like 1 month that I took off until
Slacker.
I did this one. No. Slacker's right. I did not know what I was doing. So I actually dismantled all of the frame bars that I had built on my unicycle to hold all the luggage. And I switched to a backpack. And I decided I wanted to try hitchhiking. So stuck my thumb out and from Phoenix, Arizona, I backpacked and hitchhiked about 1,000 miles to, I went all the way to the coast and then I went back up to Nevada and I made it as far as St. George, Utah.
Okay.
And the whole thing was like 10 days because I was hitchhiking. I had walked and unicycled the total of like 150 to 200 miles of that. And like 800 miles was just like riding in random strangers' cars. It was pretty incredible. I met a lot of people, but it was after the
unicycle.
Yeah.
And this was during COVID.
Yeah, but I didn't even know what COVID was. I
mean, yeah.
It was 19 years old. You just wake up one day and you're like, I want to ride a unicycle across the country. COVID was the last thing I thought of, believe me. And it never really was a problem, you know, until I got to like New Mexico. A lot of the people in New Mexico took it very seriously. So like a lot of the lockdowns and the mask regulations were pretty heavy over there. So I didn't even know. I wasn't like aware of its existence until like I was like 1,800 miles into the trip. And all of a sudden I'm walking into a Family Dollar and some guy is glaring at me like really angrily and he's like, where's your mask? And I'm like, don't shoot me. Like I did not know what was going on. But then it became a really big thing and a lot of other things happened, but call me a little bit oblivious, but that was my experience with COVID is that I just rode a unicycle across the country.
There were stories that we've covered of people that were canoe tripping across. Like, we're taking 2 months and going on a canoe trip. And when they came out, the world had shut down.
Yeah, the world
was
completely different.
They had no clue what had happened.
Yeah.
Right? It was like, wow.
Could you imagine that? Just like leaving and you're, you know, all these freedoms and everything. Right? None of it is there when you come back.
Well, we talk about going in on a, you know, 3 week canoe trip and then coming out and the zombie apocalypse has happened. Yeah. And we get back to home and no, unfortunately it hasn't.
No home.
Unfortunately.
Everybody's still there. My job's still there. Still got bills. The zombies haven't taken over.
Yeah. Rise and shine, sailors. Yeah. It'd be Monday.
Yeah. The zombies are not helping.
Yeah.
So after that, you took about just over half a year off. And then you hopped into a boat.
Yeah. So I, you know, as you can imagine, getting run over by a car at 14 years old, it left a lot of permanent damage. So I have I live with a chronic back pain for the rest of my life, which really sucks. And it does hinder a lot of the journeys. But I figure I might as well try everything. So when I got to this canoe, I was like, well, I did the unicycle and tried hitchhiking and tried walking, you know, all those are fine, but I want to try being in a boat. So I got this old 1982 Blue Hull. It was a 17 foot long open canoe. And my dad and I spent the winter building an HDPE board over the front of it. So half of it was like completely decked and
I had a
cabin for all of my luggage, completely waterproof. And the boat was its own flotation device now. And I convinced my parents, luckily, to drive me 800 miles from Michigan to Minnesota and bring me to the headwaters of the Mississippi River there in Minnesota at Lake Itasca. And they dropped me off. And on June 20th of 2022, I departed on a five-month-long expedition to the Gulf of Mexico solo and unsupported in a canoe.
Down the Mississippi.
Down the Mississippi.
From the headwaters right down. And I mean, people are doing that now.
Yeah.
But you did it solo, unsupported, had a good time.
Well, about 100 people attempt the river every year.
Yeah.
Yeah, about maybe like 40 to 60 actually succeed. And so those are the statistics for river paddlers. And when I was paddling through, I met numerous people that were not only on the river, but also residents of the shore banks that had supported people going down along the way. Yeah. There's like a group on Facebook called the Mississippi River Angels. And that's like this enormous community of river dwellers that purely in good-hearted nature want to help voyageurs and paddlers go down the Mississippi River. And it's extraordinary. You get to watch all of these different stories unfold. And most of the people that go down are veterans.
Right.
People who are generally older, 60, 70 years old, and they're later in life, and they want to go down for like a personal vendetta or something. And then every now and then you'll get like a young buck like me that's just kind of kind of a little bit nuts off of his case and wants to dip his toes in the water. And that's what I did. And I didn't know a lot of things, but I ended up doing it. I learned a lot about myself in the process.
Prior to that expedition, did you have much experience with water paddling and so on? Or was this a first?
No. This is the first. Yeah, I wanted to try everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I got to the Gulf of Mexico after 5 months. And many things had conspired on the entire journey as well. Like I had gone through things that stuck with me for a long time psychologically. Like there was a time when I had gone about like a week and a half to 2 weeks without seeing another person.
Oh, wow.
And I was out there in the middle of the Delta of the Mississippi taking a slow time. And I was on a sandbar by myself, and there'd be like this little creek flowing into the Mississippi River. So I took my cast net that I had with me, and I would throw this cast net off into the Mississippi River, standing in this little creek because it was like a flat bed, like maybe 1 inch deep of water. And I threw it in a couple times, and on like my third cast, the entire sandbank beneath my feet shifted and fell into the depths of the Mississippi River.
Oh.
And underneath that entire sandbank, as you can imagine, was mud. And just this thick mud that would consume anything that stepped in it. And so as the sand fell and shifted, I sank right into that mud. And I sank about up to my waist, but I was up to my chest in water. And so as the creek was now decreasing in its floor level, all of this water started rushing out and covering my face, and I was all alone. So this water had just been I was like gasping for air. It took about 30 seconds in total, which is, you know, painfully long to be sitting there almost drowning and trying to crawl my way out of this mud by myself. And luckily I still had the rope on my cast net, on the bottom of the Mississippi. So I was pulling on the net, which had been on the bottom with all of its weights. And if it wasn't for that, I probably would have been stuck in the mud drowning.
Wow.
I pulled myself out. I crawled out onto the land, and I spit out water, and I was sitting there choking for a minute. And I pulled my net up, and I caught a little sheep's head drum about this big, and I ate it for dinner. But
your reward.
My reward for that. I could have gone without it, but that stuck with me for a while, to the point where when I had reached other points of that expedition, because I didn't stop there. When I had reached other points, there was places with a lot of mud that would trigger some sort of like PTSD that I had for a long time. In fact, I would have like vivid flashbacks as I would step in soft mud or soft sand at points just randomly. And it was terrifying. I can't believe that I lived through a lot of those things, and especially such a young age too. It's like, wow, I was stupid.
We all have those stories.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, we always say you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, we all jumped into a canoe at some point.
Yes.
Having never been in one before, or a kayak, or what have you. You got to start someplace. All of us that go on these wild canoe adventures in the backcountry and, you know, come face to face with bears and moose and deer and wolves and all the rest of it. It's an adrenaline-seeking thing, but it's definitely an adrenaline rush when it happens.
Yeah.
And something that, and I think part of that is the reason why you never forget it. But it's the difference between a memory and what could have actually gone wrong.
And it's character development.
Right?
Yes.
It's heavy amounts of character development.
Yeah.
Especially moments like that that are just so emotionally intensive. They really do propel you into a deep state of learning and development, I believe.
Yeah.
At least it did for me as well.
And you give Sandbars a side eye ever since.
Yeah, I got a love-hate relationship with that one.
So that was 2,400 miles, 3,860 kilometers, 144 days. Now, you were, what, 20 at this point?
Yeah, I had turned 20 on the water.
Most parents, when their kids are 20, say, you know what I want to do? I want to go down and do the entire Mississippi. There's a lot of parents that are going, give your head a shake, boy.
Yeah.
So if your parents actually drive you, it's either they are supporting you or they're trying to get rid of you, one of the two.
Well, like I said, I was an Eagle Scout.
Right.
And so a lot of my youth was spent camping and fishing and doing a lot of those survival campouts. Granted, nothing ever close to as extreme as that, but like we had high adventure trips, like weekend kayaking trips. We had there was one year where we biked across the Upper Peninsula of Michigan,
right?
And it took us like 6 days. It's like 260 miles or something. It was awesome. But a lot of the experiences that I went through on these expeditions, I attribute to Boy Scouting, 100%.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's as simple as that. Getting the bug. Yeah. You know, you get bit by that adventure bug.
Yeah,
somebody want to get out there and do it.
Now. Somebody made me an addict at one point in time.
An adventure addict. Yeah.
Yeah.
You either become an adventure addict or you become a prepper.
Yeah. Yeah. Some scoutmaster at one point. Here, boy, try this.
So the Mississippi River, you enjoyed that one. That was
challenging.
Challenging, good and bad. I take it all along.
Yeah, well, the Mississippi River is past St. Louis, past the cities, it gets to be quite polluted in some of those areas. And I think this is something that's really important in today's world because we play into a lot of that pollution, not only from industrialization, but also our own pollutants that we throw into the waterway and trash areas. And like, I think it's important to understand things like this is that When I was on the water, I had contracted ringworm throughout St. Louis, and for about like 2.5 months on the water, it's known as like athlete's foot,
mm-hmm.
but it's more of a retaliation to toxins and pollutions in the body is normally how it arises, and I had contracted that somewhere along the way, and I had it on my feet from just being in the water. It was just a pollution thing at the time, and I was in denial. I didn't know what it was until about like the last month on the water, and when I had finished the Mississippi River, I had stopped to rearrange some of my equipment, and I was barefoot and I was walking on these stone plates because the Mississippi River and the lower parts have these enormous stone concrete plates that are tied together with these wires, but they're all laid like 70 years ago.
Right.
So over time, all that brackish water coming in from the Gulf of Mexico with the tides that had eroded a lot of those steel beams and rebar into these like fine needle points after like 70 years.
And so right.
I had stepped on one of these rusty wires, and it had gone clean through my foot. On the last day of the Mississippi River, I was 33 miles from the Gulf of Mexico in the middle of nowhere. Because past New Orleans, it's like 100 miles to the Gulf of Mexico, and there's nothing in that area that's like easily accessible besides the last city, which is Venice. And when I had gotten down there and that had happened, I had ringworm on my feet and now an open wound with rust leaching into my bloodstream, and I hadn't had a tetanus shot since I was a kid. I wasn't worried about tetanus, but I was more so worried about sepsis getting into my bones.
Right.
And I probably would have been fine, but when you're out there alone and you're a few days from the Gulf, you know, sepsis only takes about 24 hours. That's actually a really big scare that I had. And so I took it upon myself to make it to the Gulf of Mexico in one day. And I paddled 33 miles. It took 10 hours. And I paddled to Venice. And I took a shortcut through Tiger Pass through Venice instead of going to the traditional route. And I made it to the Gulf of Mexico. And I was brought back to Venice by a couple of kind fishermen that had driven my boat from the Gulf back the 5 miles to Venice. And I was picked up by one of my friends that I had met in New Orleans and driven back to New Orleans from Venice, which is like a 3-hour drive. And then I was brought to a charitable hospital at like 7 p.m. And I sat in the waiting room until 2 in the morning when they had admitted me. And they said, what do you need? I said, I need 2 weeks of doxycycline to clear a fungal infection on my feet. And I need a tetanus shot because I had stepped on a rusty wire and I'm afraid I'm going to get sepsis. And they took me in, and after an hour, they had given me everything I needed, given me a prescription for doxycycline. And at 3 in the morning, they come in and they said, okay, it's time to leave. I said, what do you mean it's 3 in the morning? They said, well, there's like 500 homeless people out there in the waiting room. You got to get out of here. We have more people to help.
Yeah.
And so I don't have anywhere to go. I had gotten dropped off there at 7 o'clock. The people that had dropped me off were sleeping. 3 in the morning in the highest crime rate city in America.
With
nowhere to go and no money. I didn't even have enough money to sleep in a hotel. Like I said, when I finished that expedition, I didn't really have much left. And so there I was in the streets. I made a couple of cold calls, and I ended up getting somebody to pick me up at 4:30 in the morning. And they wouldn't even let me wait outside of the charitable hospital. It was like insanity. I sat outside, and the security guards came by. They said, you can't wait here. I'm like, why? They're like, because homeless people wait here all the time, and it's bad for the, I don't know. They just didn't want me there. It was such a weird interaction. It felt like a Black Mirror episode. Like, okay, we treated you, but now you got to go get stabbed in New Orleans. It's like, what? That didn't really make a lot of sense. So luckily, I had gotten picked up from that, and 7 days later, I sold the canoe, and I took the money from the canoe and a lot of my equipment because I didn't need it anymore. And I bought a bicycle for $300, and I biked it. I biked from New Orleans to Florida, 700 miles over the span of it was about 2 months. And that was like immediately after that. During that trip, I found a cat, and it was like, I'm not even kidding. It was like the first week. It was like Thanksgiving 2022. I found this adorable little 4-month-old Siamese kitten out in the middle of the woods because I had been hosted at this guy's house. And the guy's house is like 5-7 miles away from town, right?
Right.
And it was like preposterously, like no idea how this cat got there. Like it's just, he's in the middle of nowhere. He's freezing cold. He's starving to death. And all of a sudden we hear, meow. Meow, meow. I was like, what the heck is that?
Yeah.
You know, we walk around and there he is, this 4-month-old Siamese kitten sitting under there under the steps. I say, well, isn't that peculiar? So we try to find a home for him. We try to figure out where he come from. Nothing. It's just best we got was this cat hoarder's house. It's like 5 miles away from where we were.
Right.
And it was just the closest place he could have came from. It's like hundreds of feral cats running around on the property, just all fighting for food and everything. So we're like, well, he probably came from there. And from then on, you know, I called him River, 4-month-old kitten. And I got a bag on my chest and I put him on my chest and we biked for 2 months until we got to Florida.
The cat distribution system,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, have a cat, take him with you, going to Florida, take this one.
Yeah, I was not prepared for that one. I was like, wow, out of everything, a cat. God, these tests are getting too insane. Find another soldier, please, for the love of God.
So yeah, it's when I was going through the information there, I was thinking, oh, cat. Because we've seen people with cats, and they got the backpacks, and there's people, you know, they're on canoe trips, and oh, you got a dog? No, I've got a cat. What? No,
this is my backcountry cat.
Yeah, no, apparently cats are where it's at. Yeah. So yeah, when I saw that you got this little, he's a cute one too.
Oh yeah, he's adorable,
right?
Yeah,
a nice little cat, little named him River, and that's perfect.
Yeah, quite fitting.
So you 65 days over 700 miles. You went through Louisiana, Mississippi, parts of Florida, and then you decided to do a Florida circumnavigation. Now this is January 28th to 2023 to May 19th. And on this circumnavigation,
that was also by bike.
No, this was paddling again.
I ditched the bicycle.
You're paddling.
Yep. As soon as I got to Florida, I ditched the bicycle. Got and I bought my canoe that I'm doing the Great Loop in now in Florida. And so my canoe is the 1982 Sawyer Loon. It's a decked canoe built by Verlin Kruger in the early 80s. And so my cat that I had at the time, he lived at my feet in the boat for 8 months.
It was like, wow.
Well, it was years. November to November 2022 to May 2023. So that entire time he was with me. And so the entire Florida circumnavigation as well, when we switched over, we had been living together, and he was a fun companion to have. I just swear there's a lot of times where I'd just be talking to myself, and instead I would be talking to him, which was really good justification for a lot of people to show people that you're not insane.
I'm
talking to my cat.
Yeah, exactly. So I got to
be worried when the cat starts talking back. That's the problem.
Yeah, that was the hard one to convince to people. So.
No, really, he talks.
Yeah.
So you were doing the circumnavigation. What happened to the islands off Fort Myers?
The islands of Fort Myers. Oh, my gosh.
Marooned.
You know, that was pretty preposterous. I didn't expect that to come around, because what had happened was I had got to Fort Myers. I was a little ways in, a couple weeks in, and all of a sudden these high winds come out of nowhere. It's like 30-mile-per-hour winds for 5 days straight.
Oh wow!
Ended up being on this island by myself, and so there was a couple of like moored boats in the lagoon and stuff waiting out there, weather and I had spent that time with the cat. I had a cast net at this time too, so I was catching fish for the cat to eat. So most of his diet was fresh fish. It was pretty good. Except when I got in the salt water, I had learned that giving salt water to animals makes them throw up. So whenever I gave him fish, I would either have to gut them or rinse them off, especially shrimp, because they're like so much salt content.
Yeah.
And otherwise he would just throw up his meal right after. So it was a really big learning curve trying to like have this cat and feed him and give him a biologically appropriate diet and nutrition and everything.
Because you had to take all your water with you.
I did have to carry all my water. So I had enough water to last through the 5 days. I had about 8 gallons of water. But it was, the interesting thing wasn't staying there on Fort Myers for 5 days. The interesting thing was what had conspired on the island, because although there were high winds and I was just sitting in the tent for 5 days and trying to ration food and water, there was the moored boats, and one of the moored boats had taken their dinghy and driven over to the island that I was at and pitched up some camping chairs. So I was able to meet some people for one of the days that I was there. And I went over to talk to these people, and they say, "Peter?" And I said, "Oh, me?" And they're like, "Yeah, we met you before." And I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And there were these people that I had met at Hoppy's Marina on my descent of the Mississippi River like 6 months earlier.
Wow.
It was like this, it was this happenstance moment. They were doing the Great Loop before I ever even knew what the Great Loop was.
Oh, okay.
And so they were doing the Great Loop in their boat called the Lovett. And I have a sticker on my boat from that has their boat. So I carry a little sticker of their boat on my boat. And out of happenstance, I met them at Hoppy's Marina, and 6 months later, randomly on this island that I'm marooned on by myself with this cat, we uh, we had met again. And the even more interesting thing that happened was I had prayed for a very long time in the Mississippi River to catch a fish because I was having very troubling times, like actually catching fish and sustaining a healthy diet of fish in my diet, I mean, for a while. So I was praying. I was like, oh, gosh, God, please give me some fish. Just a little bite of something fresh. Come on. So I'm tired of eating out of can. You know, these beans are getting old. So, you know, after a while, I got to Hoppy's Marina, and that day, one of the Asian carp, the highly invasive Asian carp, yep, that are swimming up our water systems,
yep,
they're really unpredictable, and they're kind of stupid, and it had jumped out of the water and landed there right at my feet as I was standing there on the riverbank.
Yeah.
And it was like, wow. I picked that sucker up. I bashed his head in with a rock, and I cooked him for dinner, and it was like the best thing ever. Like, I walked into town at Hoppy's Marina. I got like myself a little stick of butter and some, yeah, seasoning. It was like, it was heaven. I was like, oh my gosh, thank you. And I had eaten this Asian carp, and they're honestly not that bad, especially when you're starving.
Right?
Yeah, that's the trick to it. So if you're ever in a cookout, make sure your guests are starving.
It's all so good.
Right?
But this is the peculiar part, is that that was the only time that had ever happened to me until, like a fish jumping out of the water, mm-hmm, at my feet, until I had gotten to the island of Fort Myers. And as I was sitting there talking to these same people that I had met on that same day that had happened 6 months earlier, I kid you not, a mullet about this big, you know, maybe a foot long mullet, pretty good size mullet, jumps out of the water and lands there right next to my feet as I'm standing in the water right on the shoreline, as I'm talking to the same people I happened to 6 months earlier.
Maybe you just need to hang around with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I found that quite a peculiar,
right?
Yeah. Event to happen. And once again, I cooked it for dinner and River got a fresh meal of fish.
Or maybe they just happen to have fish as pets.
Trained fish.
And you've just and you eaten just two ate of their pets. Trained fish.
Secretly Jesus, and it's like two loaves of bread and two fish, and he's just feeding me.
Yeah.
He's like, he's doing fine.
We'll just throw him a fish.
He needs a little assistance. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you were doing your circumnavigation, you were meeting various people along the way that helped out. Again, that sort of, I mean, we're hearing this about the Mississippi and everything, and I know Derek does his backpacking and stuff. He talks about the trail angels.
Well, one of the people that I had met, and it was quite an interesting person. Have you ever heard of Deer Meat for Dinner on YouTube?
No.
The biggest outdoor fishing and hunting channel on YouTube. He's got like 3.5 million subscribers.
Okay.
And his name is Robert Arrington. And he had reached out to me while I was on the bicycle, and I didn't see it until I was on the canoe. And when I had purchased the canoe, I took a 2-week layover to just like transfer gear over and sell the bike and everything. And he had reached out to me and he said, I want to help you out. So I'm like, me? He's like, yeah, you're doing this like awesome thing. I want to help you out. So he reaches out to me and he takes me across the state of Florida to his house on the eastern side, and he took me out hunting. We went hunting for boar, and he took me out to one of the football games up there in Tampa. It was like this crazy event where I had been out for months on a bicycle and a canoe and everything, and I was getting ready to circumnavigate Florida. No idea what I was getting into, and all of a sudden I had no money, no equipment. I had spent everything I had on the canoe, and he says, I'm going to supply all your equipment for the canoe. And he buys me a paddle. He gets some of his sponsorships, Frog Togs, this and that. And he gets all of this equipment in the boat for me to do this circumnavigation. And if it wasn't for him, I would have had to stop. I wouldn't have had any gear. I wouldn't have had any equipment. I wouldn't have been able to feed myself or the cat. And thanks to him, I got to spend another, was it like 4 or 5 months out there paddling and having this experience. And, I really, truly owe a lot of that to him. It's like a really big thank you to the kindness that he showed me. I don't know. There's a lot of really kind people that I meet along the way. like a lot of kind people. Yeah. There's the world is filled with kindness, but that one moment where somebody like that who just has everything looks down on somebody like me that doesn't have anything and is out there just pursuing his dreams on the bare minimum, says, "I want to help you out." It just felt like a gift from God.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
They're all gifts from God, you know, but that one just hit a little bit different. But I circumnavigated Florida, and I even went as far as to do the Intracoastal Waterway of Georgia, and I made it up to South Carolina.
Now, I know you were saying Georgia was a lot of issues with the marshes and along the coast.
I go on and on about Georgia. Georgia was brutal. Oh, my gosh.
So you're saying they should just remove Georgia?
I wouldn't say remove it. But, you
know, the lower part, at least.
That's a really tough terrain to go through. And one of the reasons why is because the tides there are so unpredictable, at least my experience with them. In fact, after circumnavigating Florida, I had so much understanding with tides and tide charts and following everything that was happening with weather and with the water currents that it was... When I had gotten there, studying the tide charts for hours the night before and waking up in the morning and paddling, I would quickly find that nothing that I had studied would actually happen. The tides would come in at really weird hours. They would shift an hour earlier, an hour late, and the tides were so strong that they would create wakes pushing in and out of the channels.
Right.
And they would be up to 8 feet in elevation, up and down every 6 hours. And because of that, all of the land and the marsh there was below the tidal line. So there was nowhere to camp for at least farther than full day's worth of paddling every single day. So every day was a very, very long and winding sprint that lasted about 12 to 15 hours of paddling every single day against the current, mostly because none of the tides were actually correct. And when you had gotten to the place that you were going to sleep, it was often a bed of dead oyster shells sitting about 4 inches above the high tide line, if you were lucky. And I would have to pitch a tent on those oyster bed shells with my equipment, and it was brutal. It was like 150 miles or something like that through the Intracoastal. And if I could, I would have gone on the open Atlantic, but at that time I had no experience with open Atlantic paddling. I didn't know what I was getting myself into or anything like that. So, but I had survived it. Luckily, it was really, really difficult. I mean, I really want to address that. Like, I really want to emphasize that. It says Georgia is a very tough state, and to this day, it is the number one hardest terrain that I had ever paddled through in my life.
Oh, wow.
So you're saying you're not going back soon?
I just might have to.
Yeah, isn't this part of...
the Great Loop?
So you ended up in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And River is no longer a travel cat.
That's right. By the time I hit Hilton Head, South Carolina, I ran out of money. And if I was out there alone, I would have gotten a job at a marina or something and raised some money on my own and found a way to keep going. But it was mainly the cat. I really felt bad for the cat. I didn't think that it was fair for him to be in a world where he was being taken care of by somebody who couldn't take care of him anymore. And I had been doing a really good job with fishing and everything up until that point and feeding him. He never went hungry, and he had a really good life. But... even though it was hard, at that point, having no money to feed that cat, it wasn't fair to him.
Right.
So I had a buddy that I had met on the 10,000 islands of Florida as I was paddling through there, a couple of fishermen, and as I was up that way, I had made the call to them, and they had driven 16 hours across the United States and picked me and the cat up and driven me 16 hours back to Ohio, where I stayed for 2 weeks. And then I went back up to Michigan and I brought the cat back to my parents. And so he's been living there for the last year. So he's about 2 years old now.
And now he's a house cat.
He is a house cat, yeah. he's still trained to take him on walks.
Well, considering how you found him,
yeah,
you know, it's a far cry from there.
I think my purpose for him was to be the person that carried him to safety through all those months. And I think that his purpose to me was to provide me with the companionship to not maybe go a little bit insane.
Right? It was my excuse to make it look like I wasn't talking to myself.
Exactly. But I truly believe that his purpose in my life was companionship. I think that he was put there.
Perfect time.
Perfect timing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what animals are there for, right? When we have a, like, I mean, my canoe dog.
Yeah.
I'll be out in the canoe and I'm having a full-on conversation with her. She's just looking, I'm outside. Oh, look, there's a water, there's a deer, there's a bird. I'm having a full-on conversation. That's no clue.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
A lot about conversations, that's for sure.
Yeah. So you spent a little bit of time, and then you were back on the water again. Just the Headwaters expedition this time.
Yeah, I was kind of a little bit of an idiot there too. So I went back, and literally like a month and a half after I got back. I got back June 1st back to Michigan. Month and a half later, I met up with a buddy that I had met. Kevin Parsons. He was a biker that had done Route 66 and a bunch of other expeditions himself. Older gentleman in his 60s. And he drove from Colorado to pick me up and bring me back to the headwaters of Lake Itasca, Minnesota.
Hello, Mississippi River.
And I had spent 28 days re-paddling the first 456 miles of the Mississippi River from the first city, Bemidji, to Minneapolis. And the reason why I did that was because since it was my first expedition, there were moments where I had portage assistance around certain areas that were too difficult to get through, one of which was a 12-mile-long lake called Lake Winnebagoche. And when I had gotten there, there was a lot of talk from the locals that the lake was so ferocious that you should never cross it in a canoe. And the reason why I think that they did this was because they have a business where they charge $100 per person to portage you around the lake. So the more they get paddlers that are new on this journey that are only like a week in, they get a lot of business doing that. I don't know for sure, and I don't want to slander their business, but I ended up having to go back and re-paddle the Mississippi River to atone for those miles for whatever reason my young brain made me. And I wouldn't hate to see anybody else have to do that. So if you get that way, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. So the purpose of that is that I did all 456 miles completely under my own manpower. There were moments where I had portaged or gotten a car and they portaged me like a couple miles around like a dam or this and that. And that's normal. Everybody does it. But I just wanted to challenge myself on this trip. And so I did all 456 miles, including one, which was since I had gotten there late July, there was the Sauk Rapids, yeah, of St. Cloud. And that's a really difficult stretch to get through because you have to get there early enough to where the water is high and you can paddle through it. And when I got there, there was no water, which means that without accepting portage assistance, the portage from the first dam to the last dam is 9 miles. Oh. And I ended up walking my canoe with a wheel set and all my equipment all day, the 9 miles around the city. And it was just... I had caved both wheels in by the end of the journey. It was like, I forgot how long it took, but I was walking maybe like 2 miles an hour with all of that equipment. And I, you know, my wheels were so finicky. I had like the little spokes and the plastic things. It's like a cheap wheel set. And both wheels caved in to the point where it felt like I was rolling two squares underneath my boat. I was afraid I was going to be land bound. I was terrified, but I had made it to the end. It took, considerable amount of time. It was the better part of a morning and afternoon. And I had finished, put the boat back in and paddled a few extra miles and camped out for the night.
But you got to the end and had a great time after that.
It was a good journey. It really was. And I met a lot of the river angels and the hosts and hostesses that I met on the previous trip. Because, you know, there's the whole community of river angels throughout right. the entire Mississippi. And the majority of those people are in Minnesota. So the first 456 miles is arguably some of the best paddling of the entire river. There's little to no pollution. Yep. The water is clear, and the majority of the river angels live up there as well. So I had met a considerable amount of them. And I actually made my first film, which was called The Headwaters. Ironically, because I started at the first city instead of the 60 miles before that at the headwaters. But like I said, we're at a late part in the year. There was no water.
So, yeah, the film, you can view that on your website, correct?
Yeah, I have it on my YouTube channel.
And your YouTube channel? Now, I know your website is whereispeterfrank.com. What's your YouTube? Same.
It's just Peter Frank.
Just Peter Frank?
Yeah. So I made that. It's like a 40-minute short film, and it goes over everything I went through on the trip. But it's, let's see. There's a lot of moments on it. Like, if you want to watch it for yourself, it's really, really good 40 minutes. I put it together a few months ago from all the footage that I had during that time. And I wouldn't have had that footage if it wasn't for Robert Arrington down in Florida, because he bought me two GoPros to film my expeditions with.
Right.
So the only reason why that film exists was because of him. So again, thank you.
As for the River Angels, meeting them a second time, it's got to be from their point of view. So you were here. Did you ever make it?
Yeah, right? They get the close.
Oh yeah, okay. So he made it, and here's what happened, and get the stories from their side. I wonder how many times they actually get the follow up to how many people actually they helped actually make it down to the Gulf.
It's interesting. You know? Yeah, there's only been a number of people that have done it twice. One of which was Graybeard.
Dale Sanders.
Have you ever interviewed him?
No, I tried to get him at Canucopia a couple of years ago, but he's absolutely swamped with people constantly.
He's a busy guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting fella. I met him once on my first descent, because he lives down in Memphis. So he's got the, as you know, the wall of paddlers.
Yes.
So for like 10 years, he's been collecting all these signatures of river angels and paddlers. And I was able to sign his wall.
Cool.
And one day I have to go back there and put the end date of the Mississippi River Expedition on the wall as well. But my signature, that's where it lies.
Alrighty.
On the wall of some old kook in Memphis.
Are you famous? I'm old kook famous.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
Wrapped up, man. Like,
great guy.
Great really guy, great. Yeah. I've never heard anything bad about him.
No.
Ever. Right?
So you talked about the pollution on the river and well, you have to carry your own water if you're on the intercoastals because of the salt content and stuff. So do you filter water? Like, you must carry a filter with you, or do you rely on fresh streams and stuff?
Oh, yeah. So the Mississippi, I would not filter below the first city, like me personally.
You just can't touch the water.
Well, you can touch the water.
I mean, like, you know, you can't consume it, so you don't even bother.
If you're consuming it for, like, weeks on end, I'd be a little bit cautious about that, just from personal experience. Yeah. I mean, when you this is going to sound a little bit absurd, but when I was down on the lower parts of the Delta, there were points, and I may have been hallucinating, but there were points where there were pumps sticking out of the water. They would go into the water, and then there's these giant machineries where these pumps would stick out of the water, and there'd be like this brown, grotesque liquid spraying out of these pumps into the Mississippi. And although it could have been mud and other things, it just looked like raw sewage, and it smelled awful. And I would see that a number of the points. I don't know what they are. And the likelihood that it is raw sewage being dumped into the Mississippi River is very, very low. But the water that they're dumping in there, whatever was coming out of there, definitely wasn't clean. I don't know what it was, some kind of pump of some sort. I would see things like that, and I've seen a lot of dead fish as well. You see a lot of the pollution, and as you get down below St. Louis, you can see the industrialization. and all of that just being right on the river's edge.
Right. Right.
Everything is being manufactured and produced. Even the canoe that I had done the Mississippi in had been born in those factories,
yeah,
causing all of that pollution. So mm-hmm. it's kind and of
it
ironic.
It is a working river as well.
It is.
Right? Yeah. So all the pollution of the boats going up and down.
That's
and
how we get all of the produce and the equipment, materials, metals, all mm-hmm. of our all of the things that we use to operate in everyday life. You know, the nails in the table that we're sitting at right now. It's like, all we need these rivers to function as a society, especially with this much population. So it's difficult to protest against something like that, but it's always good to be mindful of the existence of it.
Yeah, definitely.
So did you pull from streams that poured into the Mississippi to get your water supplies for drinking? And
I carried all my own water on the Mississippi and on the bike expedition and on the Florida expedition.
And just in jugs and stuff.
Yeah, I carried all my own water until this trip when I was a little bit more prepared. I had reached out to Sawyer Water Filters, which is one of my five sponsorships now for this Great Loop trip. And Sawyer gladly sent me a number of their filters to try out on this trip. And for the entire journey from the Great Lakes to here in Canada on the Trent Severn Waterway, I have been filtering my own water. I haven't had to carry anything more than a half gallon in the boat at any given time.
Isn't that great?
It is amazing. Like, water is like the heaviest thing. Until I reach the Atlantic Ocean, I'll be filtering all my own water with their Sawyer water filters. It's been a really big blessing to not have that extra weight.
Exactly. Yeah.
We've been on canoe trips into the backcountry, and you're watching people, they're carrying big blue jugs of water.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're carrying cases of plastic water bottles, you know, like the one you buy in the store.
Into the jungle?
No, up north Ontario.
Yeah, it's just here in Ontario.
Yeah.
Yeah, into the backcountry.
I think it's just inexperienced people. They don't know that they can filter water.
Yeah. No one's got it. What do you mean there's a filter? Said yes.
Yeah, it's like magic.
Yeah,
yeah.
I've got the Platypus 4-liter filter that it's a 4-liter bag.
Yeah,
and I scoop it and fill it and seal it, and there's a hose that runs out of the bottom of that through a filter into a second 4-liter bag. So you got 4 liters, and it hangs. It's gravity filter.
That's awesome.
So you just hang it, and while you're getting stuff ready or whatever, you're packing your boat or whatever, it's filtering the water while you're doing other things.
That's great. I have one of the best things that I had was the Sawyer sent me this this water bottle with a filter built into the tube, and so you pop it open and it has a straw, and you can just fill it up out of the side of the boat, and you could just suck out of the straw and drink from that all day. It filters like 100,000 gallons or something like that. Yeah. It's like
so insane. easy. Well, it was like we had the Grail. Yeah. You scoop up, and then there's an insert that you push down with a filter at the bottom.
Cup within a cup.
Yeah.
And you just push it through the water. The water goes from the bottom cup through the filter into the upper cup.
And then you just drink from the upper
cup. Oh, that's super convenient.
There's so many. Yeah, really, really cool. So Sawyer's got the one with the straw out that you can just suck the dirty water, and it filters it as you're drinking it.
Yeah, I look through a lot of brands to try and find something like as easily accessible as that, you know.
I mean, when we started, it was the MSR water pumps, and had either the push one or the crank
with
one.
The clay filter.
Yeah.
And
after a while, you're
ceramic filter. Yeah.
Trying to pump these things, and you're just like, you know what?
That's some of the first ones that came out.
I'm just going to drink from the lake. Yeah. I don't care anymore.
I did that a couple of times, you know, on the upper Mississippi up by the headwaters. You could just, it looks so clear and delicious. You just put a cup in there, and then all of a
sudden. Because we have the Nalgene bottles, right?
Yeah.
And what we always said was, undo the lid, but hold it closed with your finger. Reach over the boat as far as your arm will go down under the surface, because you don't want to take it right from the surface.
Water. No.
And then let your finger off. The lid will open, and your Nalgene will fill with water. And then you use your hand, and you put the lid back on, pull it out.
Oh, it's genius.
And that water is clearer than, you know, I mean, you're reaching like a foot or so down, right?
Yeah.
So you got that nice, cleaner water without all the surface scum and stuff like that. We do that whenever it's in a pinch. I still do that to this day. And unlike Derek, I don't get beaver fever.
I only got it once.
It's once more than I got it. But yeah, I mean, if you're as you say, if you're going to do it constantly,
yeah,
I'd be a bit aware.
Yeah,
but if you do it once in a blue moon, sort of deal.
Yeah, I would do it once in a blue moon.
Yeah. But you got to do what you got to do, man.
Mm-hmm. So when you do the section where you're for the coastal portion of the Great Loop, are you going to have a like a hand pump reverse osmosis to clean your to clear out the salt, or are you going to just rely on getting ashore to find a source of fresh water?
Yeah, so there's one. So from experience being on the Atlantic side, there's so many marinas that I think I'm going to just carry all my own water with
yeah.
me. I think I'm going to probably carry 5 gallons at a time, which is a lot, but it's that's what I did in Florida.
Better be safe than sorry, especially yeah. when you start getting into the heat exactly, and everything yeah, like that. Yeah. You don't want to be dehydrated.
And it's not like he's doing any portages, so he won't have to carry yeah. it. So,
do you, when it comes to dehydration, do you use anything in your water? Like, I know a lot of people do the Gatorade. I used to do the great Gatorade crystals and stuff like that to replenish your electrolytes and...
You know, some people have been giving me those things, like the Mio's and the yeah. Gatorade ones, and more importantly, the electrolytes and the vitamin C packets, like emergency.
Yeah.
Like, I love those so much. I'll carry a couple of those, but I'll do a lot of, like, vitamin C packets for, like, the flavoring, but not only flavoring, but, of course, like, the actual minerals and nutrients
yeah.
in it. I'll do that quite a bit. And it's always a sad thing when they run out. It's like,
right?
It's like, all right, back to plain water.
Yeah. Yeah. Even now, like, I mean, just my regular day-to-day life, it's like I'll be drinking water. I'm just like,
something's missing.
So I just go and make some juice. Because you're just missing that flavored water, right?
Yeah, it's a luxury to have it out here. I mean, it's sugar, yeah. sugar and, like, sweetness, that particular flavor, it's not yeah. something you get out here because the food yeah. that you're carrying is so vital and important because you're trying to sustain yourself, not like have snacks all the time.
Yeah.
So I find that like I'm not actually filling up a lot of my food storage and capacity with sweets and like and treats and things like that. So really the only thing that I have to taste something that's sweet is these little packets.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I started with the whole Gatorade thing, the powder. Mm-hmm. Take the powder with the little scoop and put it in your Nalgene and shake them up. But after a while, they just weren't doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few years back, my wife's a nurse. So they had this thing at the hospital, and she picked up these BioSteel. Same thing, just different company.
Yeah.
But the difference between the Gatorade and the BioSteel, I guzzle water when I'm out there. I just absolutely guzzle. And I was some of these bigger trips on really hot days like today. I'm just by the end of the day, it's like I can't do anything. I am so dehydrated.
Yeah.
I started using these BioSteel ones. What a difference! Absolute difference. Problem is, you end up.
Yeah.
It all comes down to the price point at the end, where it's like, So yeah, we wait till the winter when they're on sale. then we buy some. But yeah, that's replenishing those electrolytes when you're out on these big trips is huge.
Well, sodium is an electrolyte.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like when you consume salt, you know, it's an electrolyte that also, ironically, as salt does, aids in your hydration. So when you drink a lot of plain water with nothing in it, what it does is it dilutes your sodium content, resulting in dehydration because you have no electrolytes. So when you replenish your electrolytes, the genius behind it is that you're not drinking plain water. You're drinking something with electrolytes in it to replenish your electrolytes that you're also diluting. So when you drink like tons and tons of plain water, that's how you get dehydrated, ironically.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of people don't understand that.
Yeah.
And especially when I'm out there, I try not to drink like 2 gallons of water a day because I'll end up going to the campsite at night and I'll be like, I have no energy. I'll wake up in the morning. I'll just be so tired and thirsty. And then I'll just have to keep drinking and it's just this endless cycle.
You're peeing all day too.
I found the solution to that. It's about a 28-ounce empty Gatorade bottle in the boat.
You've got the pee bottle.
Yeah.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 expeditions.
Well, to be fair, the Mississippi River, the bike expedition, the Florida Circumnavigation was all in one go. And that was like 11 months straight.
Yeah, we'll still divide them.
I never stopped.
I just never stopped. Expedition, expedition, expedition. So let's talk about your look. I know I read that after your unicycle trip, your hair was matted, so you ended up with dreadlocks.
Yeah.
And then you shaved those off.
Well, what happened was is that I, you know, I had matted my long hair sleeping in the tent for so many months because I was so dumb I didn't break a comb. And
I don't need one.
Yeah, not even for your beard?
Well, the beard I do now, yeah, but the hair, I just wash and go.
Yeah. So I thought, man, I spent so long growing this hair out. Like I don't want to just like shave it off. So I spent the month that I spent in Arizona visiting with my sister. I had bought a little crochet needle for crocheting, and I just spent like hours and hours a day in the mirror just running this crochet needle back and forth. I had no idea how to give myself dreadlocks. I was a white dude with straight hair that had matted my hair sleeping in a tent. My hair was not cut out for dreadlocks, let's be honest. So when I had done this for so long, it kept falling apart, so I kept doing it. No wonder why it took a month to do it, but after a while I started getting the hang of it, and I created like these dreads that had matted together, but you know, I'm a white dude with straight hair, so they kept falling apart. So I'm like, well, I go to the thrift store, I buy all these like painted wooden beads, and it's like a ton of them, and I just start just throwing them in the hair and decorating all of my hair with these enormous like wooden beads, and it was so funny, and I had all tied together, and I kept those in for like up until the end of the Mississippi River expedition. And when I finished at New Orleans, after I was treated at the hospital a couple days later, I went to a barber shop and I said, I want to just shave bald. I just want it all gone. So that's what they did. They cut off all my dreadlocks. They stuck them in a box, and they're sitting somewhere on a tall shelf in my childhood bedroom.
And there they shall remain.
And there they shall remain.
You know what? Hey, you got to laugh at yourself at one point, right?
Yeah.
All these little... you got to do it. Yeah. Bald's the way to go. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Easy care.
But after I had gone home... after the dreadlocks and everything, before the Mississippi River, I'd spent the summer sewing my own three-pointed leather pirate tricorn completely by hand, and it took 6 months. Here it is right here. This thing is heavy as all heck, because the brim I had sewn in a copper wire to keep it shaping. And if you look on the bottom, you can see the rough work in the inside of the cap.
Yeah,
but yeah, I had sewn that with a 20-pound test fishing line, and deer skin that was donated to me by a dear friend. Asya was her name, and she had given me her deceased husband's old deer skins that she had been collecting since he had passed away, that he had shot. That's back cool. In the 80s. So she gave me a few hides, and I made something out of them. And then on the trip, I started meeting mayors, and it was quite possibly the funniest thing that I had ever done, because what had happened was, after making this three-pointed leather pirate tricorn, I got the rest of the ensemble, and I started dressing like a pirate. So for the entire Mississippi River, as you can imagine, I was this river pirate, and the nickname started catching on, and it was Pete the Pirate. And although as much as I hated it, that's what my name was. And I tell you, the funniest thing that I had done on these expeditions was I met with political figures, mayors in particular, sometimes parish presidents, and all of the little tiny pins on this hat that you see here, I have...
They're city pins?
I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 pins. The majority of them are from political figures. And so what had happened was I would meet people who knew the mayor or knew parish presidents, and they would put me in touch randomly. I wouldn't even ask, and they would just take me to this courthouse, and they'd just be like, I have somebody for you to meet. And the mayor would come out, and he'd be like, hello there, young man. And I'd say, hello, and we'd shake hands. So he'd take a picture of us, and I'm sitting there 20 years old dressed like a pirate, and this guy's like a very serious political figure, and they put me on their Facebook page, and all of a sudden, no context whatsoever. It's just this guy that's just dressed like a hooligan shaking hands with a very serious political figure. And I just found that to be, it just cracked me up every time I thought about it. And it just kept happening. I met, let's see here. I met, I met the mayor of Natchez, Mississippi. I met the mayor of Orange Beach, Alabama. I met Billy Hughes, the mayor of Gulfport, Mississippi. I met the president of the St. Bernard Parish government in New Orleans. And then I have a pin here from the Archangel, Janet, of the Mississippi River Angels from Bemidji here.
That's cool.
And a couple other miscellaneous ones that I collected along the way. A dear friend, Lee Bergstrom, which was one of the River Angels of the Upper Mississippi. He had given me a prostate awareness pin.
That's cool. That's cool.
Very neat.
You know, yeah, like you say, you're just this hooligan-looking guy. Yeah,
it's quite preposterous.
But you know what? It's so when we first started the podcast, I started growing this beard. And then because... Not for anything specific, but I was surprising my wife with a trip to Iceland. So she kept asking, why are you growing the beard? Oh, you'll see. By the time we did the trip to Iceland and came back, everybody knew me with the beard.
You were the Viking.
So I couldn't shave it after that. Because even when, you're the beard. I remember, you're the podcast guy.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, great. So it sticks. Right?
Yeah, the nickname's
you're Peter the Pirate.
And it helps, too,
and it
because
helps.
He's a very ugly man without the beard.
Yeah.
He hates one to no one.
Well, a lot of it happened through there. You know, so I dressed like a pirate all the way to the end of the Florida circumnavigation. And when I finished and I went back to Michigan, my clothes were, like, falling off of my body. I was purchasing my clothes from Goodwills and thrift stores.
Yeah.
Because it was the only place I could find, like, slops like that that would fit the style.
Right.
And so when it came down to it, you know, I made the hat. And I went out to California for a year. And I went out there to just kind of... It was my first time living on my own outside of my parents' house.
Right.
So I had no idea what to expect in society. I'd spent, like, 2 years straight just, like... on these expeditions, traveling and just enjoying the world for what it was. I had no idea how to pay taxes. I had no idea what, what taxes were. I didn't know anything.
The stuff they don't teach in school.
Exactly. Yeah. So stuff they shouldn't be teaching you.
Exactly. So when I had gone out there, one of the things that I had done was I started making my own clothes. And a lot of my clothes that I carry on this expedition now I made myself.
Like, oh, okay.
These pants that I have, I sewed completely by hand with a needle and thread. It took a better part of an afternoon. And I cut them up out of a cotton canvas from an old painter's cloth. And I have a lot of other arrangements here. I modified the belt that I found on the side of the road to make it longer. So now it's a 60-inch long waist belt that I have because I made some extensions and some repairs to it because it was falling apart. And of course it went along with the pirate hat because,
yeah.
When you make things with a needle and thread, they kind of look pretty sloppy. So, fit the style. It's pretty good, yeah.
But it's your style, man.
Yeah.
And it's working.
Yeah. So now I'm Pirate Pete, I guess. And I run around dressed like a pirate. I just really like sewing. I really like making my own stuff. The truth behind it is I'm just a creative person. And I loved using my hands to do stuff
exactly,
and
yeah.
be occupied. Mm-hmm. And what it turned into is just kind of, this. So it just turned into a little bit of a style.
And is it comfortable when you're paddling?
It's so comfortable.
See?
It's the best thing ever. I will attest for it any day of the year.
There you go. So we should all be dressing like this.
Yeah,
it's all like forget like all this Fjall Raven stuff.
I think we should divide the world into two people. People who dress in suits and are very serious political figures and people who dress like pirates.
Right? I would have no problem with that.
Yeah.
All I need is the eye patch and a peg leg and a hook hand.
Yeah.
I've already got the beard. So after all of this, now you are doing the Great Loop. So... Great Loop is a 6,000-mile nautical adventure. It takes you through some of North America's greatest cities, historic sites, and heartlands. At its essence, it's circumnavigation of the U.S. and part of Canada. So the route... Now, we'll got a question for you after this. It's the Atlantic Intercoastal Waterways, the Chesapeake Bay, C&D Canal... the Atlantic Ocean from Cape May to New York Harbor, sometimes inland waterways through part of New Jersey, the Hudson River, the Erie Canal, the Oswego Canal, Lake Ontario, the Trent Severn Waterway, which is where we are now, Georgian Bay, Lake Michigan, the Illinois River, the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, the Tennessee River, the Ten Tom Waterway, Mobile Bay, Gulf Intercoastal Waterway, and the Okeechobee Waterway. Everybody I've talked to tend to do it going down the Mississippi, down and around, and coming back up, because I guess with the direction of the Mississippi, that's
the what I've always
the flow direction. Yeah, you're doing it the other way. So you started in Michigan. Is there, just basic long and short of it, is there a reason you're doing it clockwise instead of counterclockwise?
I thought it would be funny.
Okay, that works. That works. I'm just curious. That's all.
Yeah, I'm aware that I'm doing it backwards. Because I did pretty much half of it. I mean, like, I pretty much did half of it forwards. But the truth of the matter is, I could stop it. I could stop in South Carolina and do the entire thing in segments, because it all counts for it.
You know? Right.
But when you're out here on the trips and you get going and you spend months on end preparing all your food and everything, and then you get out here and you're 150, 180 days in, it's just, you don't just want to just stop. You know, it's like, where, me personally, where am I going to? Where am I going to when I stop these journeys? The only place that I go to when I stop these journeys into it is into a house to think about the next journey to go on.
Right.
And so for me, if I'm on one of these journeys that are very meaningful to me and it's going well and I have the funds to do it, I want to be out here for as long as possible. So as I'm going into the winter and the cold regions, and I'm going through a lot of these areas, I'm finding that even though I may be overlapping with some of my trip, I think it's going to be well worth it to just redo some of those. Because for one, if I can make it to Florida before winter, I'll be able to spend another winter in the warmth without the penalty of cold snow and ice and frigid waters.
Mm-hmm.
And my time in Florida was very, very pleasant. It was difficult, but it was very pleasant. I enjoyed it thoroughly. It was one of my favorite states that I had ever paddled through. So I would not be opposed to spending another winter there, even if I'm overlapping old miles.
Old routes, yeah. So you launch from Escanaba, Michigan at the end of June.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so I had started, and then I kind of biffed it. I was like 2 days in and I started my morning. I ended up like nose diving in some like whitecaps that were coming on the shore because I was impatient. And I took like a long reflection. I'm like, okay, you've never been on the Great Lakes before in a canoe like this. Like, what are you doing wrong? And so I had to rethink my entire setup. I had a spray deck that was not expedition ready yet. It was made for short lake paddling and, you know, intercoastal waterways where the waves don't kick up that much. So I actually had to reach out to one of my sponsors, which was Red Leaf Designs. They're since my boat is 42 years old, there's no spray deck that exists for it.
Right.
There's nothing that exists. There may be somewhere some kind of antique thing, but it's so impossible to find something like that. And typically they come in a set. So Red Leaf Designs, they make expedition spray decks for canoes and kayaks. And they make custom ones. And so I had reached out. They're up there in Upper Michigan, where I am. And they remade me another spray deck, completely custom made. And they donated it to the trip, which was really, really nice.
Oh, that's cool.
It was awesome. Like, it was a huge expense off my shoulders. And I'm really thankful that I had that. Because, you know, after you biff it in the water and you fill the canoe up with water and you're just kind of sitting there, stuck in the mud. I sat there like Napoleon, almost like sitting on the beach, just staring off into the water. I'm like, all right, something needs to change. So I reached out, and they're like, we have these ideas. I put buttons into the bottom side of my gunnels, right around the combing lip,
yep.
And I snap in the spray deck to be fixed to the boat. So when I flip upside down, nothing falls out. And
exactly.
And I also have they are archways, like plastic archways, that prop up the spray deck.
Okay. So when just shed water.
So a lot of modern kayak spray decks have that. So this is what they had fixed into my spray deck when they made it as well, which was a lifesaver because 7 days into my second attempt, 2 weeks after I had had this happen and got all these things arranged, I was 7 days into my second attempt and I had gotten in some bad weather and I flipped the canoe upside down in really rough waters, 14 mile per hour winds, 1 mile offshore, and I had to swim back to shore.
Oh, wow.
And thanks to the spray deck, nothing was lost. I was like very, very relieved at if I had my old spray deck, I definitely would have lost.
You would have lost stuff.
I would have lost my camera for sure. And I had all of my footage on there, but like I said, like the spray deck was, I'm going to have one for my future boats from them as well. It's just definitely a must have.
It's a must have for the expeditions. So you've been through Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, and you're currently paddling the Trent Severn on your way to Lake Ontario. Now you are stopping at Lovesick Lake.
Yeah, that's right.
For a little get together with Lovesick. What is it, Pat? Not Lovesick. Kayaking?
Yeah, Lovesick Kayaking. They have a group over there that does tour guides.
Right.
And so they have heard about my expedition. So when I'm going through there, they're going to be waiting for me over at Lock 30, and we're going to spend a day paddling together with a whole group of kayakers, which is going to be really cool because I haven't had that really happen at all yet.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's cool. Have you found any differences so far in comparison to your other trips with the Great Lakes and the lock systems? Because a lot of yours has been like Big Mississippi and stuff like that.
So
now you're with the
unique
locks, you're okay, I'm paddling so far, and then I gotta stop. Paddle so far and then a lock. Paddle
yeah,
so
they're
far,
on
and
a schedule.
Lock. Yeah.
And it's a big expense too. It's like $100 for a permit. And it's camping isn't that bad. It's pretty cheap to camp. But yeah, the lock system's definitely on a schedule now. And a third of the Trent system is upriver going the direction that I'm going.
Yep.
So I'm all done with that now. I'm downriver. I've reached the highest point, so now I'm all flowing downriver.
And what are you thinking of all the wall-to-wall cottages along?
Yeah.
Well, we're at one right now.
Yeah. Yeah. That's when we paddled it, you're like, when you get south of here, like it's like, oh, there's open space. If you wanted to pull over.
Oh, there is?
The side of the lake. But here, when you get up this way, starting up, like it's like wall-to-wall.
Yeah,
both riverbanks. It's just nonstop
everywhere.
Docks, like, and cottages.
Nowhere to stop.
Yeah,
you have to time your locks and everything.
Yeah, I remember having to stop like with a rainstorm. We had a bad thunderstorm and lightning. We had to get off the water, and we're on somebody's property under the trees. And you're just like, well, if they want to kick me off, they're going to have to fight. Because I'm staying here.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. The Trent system is beautiful, honestly, and the people here are even more beautiful. It's like, I think for the majority of the last week, I've just been surrounded by people, just all different stories and backgrounds and places that they've been coming from. A lot of people that I've been meeting have cottages up here that they built themselves.
Yeah.
And that's been really interesting too, to like kind of see the history of what makes the waterway system an actual system. And it's this waterway system is only 200 years, I found out.
Yeah, 200
years
old. And there's a lot of history too with it, how it was put off and then started again and everything. But what did you think of the Big Chute Marine Railway?
Oh my gosh,
wasn't that cool?
It was so cool. It's like this enormous elevator that just like I didn't even know about it until I got there. And I was like, oh my god! I had gotten there. I'm like, nobody told me it was an elevator. Like, holy crap! So they had prop me up on the lift, and they bring me all the way up to the top, and I'm getting like all these cool videos and stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, please keep your hands and feet inside the ride.
the last time I was there, there was a few boats because the boats end up in these cradle straps because it's a big lock, but it comes out of the water. Up on rails, right? And then over the hill. But there's these big boats on the straps, and then we're sitting there in our canoes right on the bottom, and you're waiting, if those straps break, I'm a goner.
That boat's going to roll right over.
Oh, my God. That's terrifying. Luckily, I wasn't right underneath them. There was a huge yacht behind me.
Yeah.
But it was like the contrast is like that huge yacht on one side. I'm like, gosh, I hope this thing isn't top heavy.
And then there is the lift lock, the Kirkfield lift lock.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That was pretty neat where you just fills up.
There's a lot of yachts through there, too, trying to get up.
And then Swift. Is it Swift Rapids?
Yeah.
Swift Rapids. Because we came it the other way. And then it just goes down and down and down and down. And
there's a couple locks that are like...
And then, when you're down at the bottom and you're looking way up at these doors, and it's like something out of the Lord of the Rings, these doors just open, right?
Yes.
And you're like, oh, wow. This is... You don't realize how deep these things are.
Yeah.
So then, of course, you're paddling coming this way, so you're paddling into it. This giant box that all of a sudden closes behind you and is on going up and going up and going up and going. Okay, come on. I got lunch. Let's go, guys. Let's keep this going. But there's some really cool. Wait till you get to the Peterborough lift lock. That one's pretty cool.
That's huge. Oh,
yeah. That one's a big one. Yeah.
How long did it take you to paddle the entire Trent?
We did it in just over a week.
Really?
Yeah.
But you didn't do the whole thing.
No, we skipped a couple of parts because we were filming a TV show at the time. So there was a couple, like we skipped Simcoe.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was a couple other ones we skipped as well just to get around for, because when you're filming the show, okay, here's us. Episode one, we're paddling 8 hours in a lake.
Yeah.
That people don't want to see
dumb
that,
show.
Right?
Yeah. So, I document my own journey, so I know exactly.
So, but there's some really good lift locks there and some really cool ones too. So you got a long way to go. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
It's amazing.
This won't be the last time you're asked this, but why are you doing the Great Loop?
What inspired you? Is it
just because
it seemed like the couple that you met 6 months apart when the fish jumped at your feet, they were doing the Great Loop. Is that where that's where you first heard of it? Were they your inspiration to get you to do the Great Loop yourself, or what gave you the idea to do it?
Well, I had started researching it from them, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the Great Loop, I think, is a journey of self-discovery. I think that you find who you are by exploring who you are not. And I have been around the unicycles and the bicycling and whitewater canoeing and hitchhiking and walking and all sorts of different things in the world that I've come pretty close now at such a young age to discovering what I really, really love. And that for me is canoeing. I love canoeing. I love it like more than anything. Like I can't even like describe to you in words my love for this sport. It's just, you're so silent on the water, you get to be immersed in wildlife that doesn't even know you're there half the time. The people that you get to meet along the shores of these waters, there's boating communities, there's towns that can only be seen from the top of this glass that covers our planet. And above all that, you can catch fish, delicious, delicious fish. Gosh, I love fish. Oh my God. And so, long story short, I got to this point in my life because I've explored enough of who I didn't want to be. And although I don't regret any of the places that I've been or the things that I've done, it has played a significant role in discovering who I'm meant to be. And for right now, in the brevity of my time as a young 20-year-old male, I'm a canoeist. And I'm going to do the Great Loop at a young age, or at least I'm going to try.
Everybody enjoys doing it. Everybody comes to it for a reason, right? Yeah. And as long as they stick with it and have fun doing it, and it brings meaning to their life, then that's what you're meant to do. Do you have a goal for your trip? Your trip, like timeline wise?
I'm going to do it until I go broke. Yeah. But like, either I succeed or I go broke. So my timeline, I'm going to do it until I can't. I think that's my goal. So as long as I can do it, and this time I don't have the cat with me, which I'm a little bit bummed out about, but you know, the boat life is no place for a cat. So I'm going to do this until I have to stop at a marina and work or whatever it takes. And,
right.
And, then I'm just going to keep going.
Well, it's not like the loop's going anywhere.
Yeah.
No. So you, like you say, you do it till you can, and then you got to work for a while, and then you just continue on from where you left off.
Yeah.
That's the great thing about these.
So yeah. Are you right. planning on doing it, continuous, or because right now your plan is to find yourself in Florida for the winter. Like, are you planning on doing a multi-year, or is it going to be once through? You're going to get down to Florida winter, make your way across, and then up again. And so winter will be in southern U.S., and then you're going to continue up the Mississippi as summer approaches again. Is that the intent?
So this is the hard part, is that since I'm doing it backwards, I have a couple of options going up through the middle of the United States. From Mobile Bay to Chicago, which is Lake Michigan, is 1,300 miles. And about 1,000 of those miles is upriver. And the difficult part of this is that if I do it in the spring, it will be near impossible because of the spring runoff.
High flow, yeah.
And if I do it in the winter, it'll be very, very cold. And I'll get to a point where there's so much ice that I can't paddle through. But the benefit to doing it in the winter is that there's no alligators.
That's a plus on our books.
But if I attempt it in the summer, there will be alligators and the water current will be difficult, but maybe possible, especially if I do the Tom Bigbee waterway. But if I do it in the late fall, around this time, September, November, then I could paddle up the Tom Bigbee waterway with virtually no significant water current to hinder my progress. It's cold enough to where the alligators are very, very slow, and I can make it far enough up to where I'm needing to go before the cold starts to really set in and the ice starts to freeze over. But that would require me to go very, very fast. Because if I don't make it back, then I will be stuck, and right. I will have to stop the trip because there is no water to float on. So I have a couple of options, and I've been thinking about it a lot, and I have the next 8 months of my life to think about it. But I think I want to cross that bridge when I get there.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it depends on what time of year I get there.
Just go with the flow. Right?
Until I get to the top.
Until then. Unless you can harness the alligators to pull your boat. There does that count?
It's like a dog team, eh?
Right?
An alligator team.
That'd be awesome. Mush! Mush! And then they turned on me.
And that was the end of the great Captain Peter Frank.
The old ballad of Captain Pete.
The ballad, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can lay out your plans as you want, but as they say, even the best laid plans, right? So mm-hmm. you plan for the best and then adjust as needed.
Yeah.
Do you have any of the biggest hopes for the trip?
Have fun. Meet a lot of people. Have a lot of experiences. Most definitely. I think that's my biggest hopes. Everything else I can endure. You know, endure what can be endured. And I just... I hope that these trips inspire people as they once inspired me. I think the only reason why I'm doing these trips is because there were my predecessors that have done them before me.
Right.
And as I mentioned, many really great people, Ed Pratt, Gary Gray, there's even others who were Alexander Doba, the man who kayaked mm-hmm. solo and unsupported across the Atlantic 3 times and then summited Mount Kilimanjaro and went to sleep.
That guy had quite the resume.
Quite the resume.
Any massive fears about the trip?
Alligators.
Alligators. I was expecting
alligators.
Alligators and quicksand.
Is there any parts of the loop that you're especially looking forward to?
I think Florida again will be fun. I think it's going to be kind of like a repeat of the Mississippi, where I met a lot of the people the year before. There was a lot of people that I met in Florida. And I mean, like, even today, I just passed by the locks, and there was a couple people in an enormous boat, and they waved me down. They said, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I'm doing the Great Loop." They're like, "Oh my gosh, are you going to be down in Florida?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to be down in Florida." They're like, "We have a cottage down there. We go down there during the winter, and if you're going to be down there in the winter, we will host you at our cottage down in Florida." And I met them up here in Canada. How preposterous is that?
Yeah.
Well, a lot of snowbirds go down.
Yeah.
Even the more preposterous thing is about 30 minutes before I met those people, the rain started to pick up, and I thought it was going to storm, and a couple of people said, "Are you okay? Come over here." And so they had me over, come over to their dock, and I said, and I went and checked the weather under their thing right before I went through the lockage. And they said, "Yeah, we have a cottage down in Florida. When you get down there, we will gladly host you at our cottage." And so it's just like this chain of events where, like, you're
hopefully
meeting.
Hopefully, they're not neighbors.
Oh my God, that'd be a short day.
Right? One dock to the next.
You almost feel bad telling them about each other because they're like, "Well, he's going to be fine anyway."
Yeah.
You know.
So where'd you stay last night? Neighbor's house.
But it's so lovely. Like, I keep meeting these people. They're filled. Like, they fill the world, like, abundantly.
Yes.
And this was something that I was never aware of until I actually went out there and started exploring myself. I mean, we get trapped in such a bubble, like almost like an echo chamber of just negativity and pain and suffering in the world. I mean, like, that's what sells the most, right? It's catching. It's entertainment. It's entertainment. It's all the entertainment industry. And we see it everywhere we go. Newspaper headlines, news, media, everything, social media, and when we walk out there in the world and we turn off and we tune out all of those, the echo chamber of noise bouncing back and forth into our ears trying to grab our attention for every little thing, we'll witness real human interactions between two people on journeys through life trying to experience reality for its entirety. And going out there on a unicycle or on a bicycle or canoe or walking and hitchhiking, you meet these people constantly. I mean, predominantly, the majority of my expeditions have been just nice people. In fact, I truly believe that these expeditions could have only been done by the kindness of these people. And for the most part, these people are what make the expeditions worth it to me. And for a lot of people like
me. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, actually, sort of jumping ahead to my next thing here. Last person we chatted with about the Great Loop said he was amazed at the number of people who reached out to help him along the way. We talked about our buddy Mike Ranta, who has paddled across Canada 3 times. He says the same thing. Some of our previous paddling trips, you know, we found this out now, and you found this out. So my question would be, which you've just answered, is how much of a boost is it to get unexpected help, and how much does it contribute to the success of your trip, having all these people reach out and help you?
Oh my gosh.
Like you just said, it's awesome meeting all these people, and they lend a hand, and the nice and positive and all that. So, I mean, without all these people reaching out and
there would be no
hand,
trip.
There would be no trip.
It's and I find this the way with a lot of people is that like you'll follow people online and you'll see documentaries about like people going on long voyages, and if they're, you know, there's a certain select people that do it specifically for the athletic part of the journey, but for a lot of the people that actually go touring and like take their time and like play the seasons and meet people, you'll see time and time again there's just like this plethora of kindness to be shared in the world. It's like people want to share it. People want to receive kindness. People want to give kindness. Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. And so what I find is that the more you smile on these expeditions, the more people smile back.
And how many people do you think are looking at what you're doing and said, "You know what? I'm going to help him out." A, because going to help them out, and B, I want to touch that. I want to be part of that because I don't have the ability to do that massive trip he's doing.
You get to live a little bit vicariously.
Right?
You live vicariously through you by you doing
so. They're benefiting from that, and you're benefiting from their... So it's a mutual kindness thing.
Yeah, most definitely. Know? Yeah, there's a lot of people that have told me that they live vicariously through my journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really heartwarming thought to know that there's people out there being inspired to live their life to the fullest, even if they can't to the extent that I'm doing. They go out there every single day and put their all in, whether it's going to the job and like doing their absolute best job at that job today, or being a really good father for the time that they're raising their kid, like things like that. And they get inspired from role models in their own lives, just as I was inspired from role models in my life to do what I'm doing. And my journeys help a lot of people live vicarious. I guess, sorry, I'm like, what I'm trying to say is that the people are really important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like going on journeys where there's no people. I wouldn't want to go on journeys where there's no people. I'm not so reclusive that I could tolerate that for long periods of time.
Yeah.
And I think that says something about humanity and the reasons why we need to connect to each other.
And these people that you're meeting are full on part of the trip.
Full on.
And it's totally a boost.
Like I remember pretty much everybody that I've ever met. I mean, not at one point in time, but like if you mentioned like a name or showed me a face, I'd say, I remember that person. I could tell you exactly where I met them. And I remember these people because they leave such an imprint in my life. And for a long time, I didn't really understand the imprint that I left in other people's life. I didn't have the awareness to be able to conceptualize what I was leaving behind. I didn't understand my footprint. But I understood the footprint of these people that left one in mine.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big one. Every single moment. I mean, I could tell you endless stories of people that I'd meet along the way that just give me places to stay, or just like tell stories on a campfire, or, you know, like whatever it may be, come out to an island. I mean, I met people in most redundant places. I mean, long before I ever had that boat, I met a man in the second generation model made by the same designer who paddled like, I don't know what it was. It was like 10 miles up the Mississippi River on my first descent down, and he showed up in the boat that I would eventually have a similar model of made by the same designer, which is pretty coincidence. And he came by and he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm camping out." He's like, "Do you need anything?" I'm like, "No, I'm pretty good." And he's like, "All right, well, I got some water here." He's like, "All right." So he brings me over some water. He's like, "You're doing the Mississippi?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm doing the Mississippi." He's like, "All right, I'm going to be back in a little bit. I'm going to take you out for lunch." I'm like, "Oh, okay." So paddle back. A couple hours later, sure enough, there he was. Drove all the way back and took me out for lunch. It was like, it was amazing. Told me the whole story about how he got his boat. And it was just phenomenal. Like, you, just randomly, just a random stranger that you meet on a riverbank somewhere that looks dressed like a hooligan with a pirate hat. He's like, I'm gonna take this man out to dinner. It's like, wow.
Hey guys, look what I found. You know what? And that becomes part of the experience for you and for him. You know, I mean, how was your trip? Oh, some of the people I met, you know, it's more than just paddling along the river. It's the events that happen while you're paddling.
Yeah.
Right. And that's exactly what you're going through right now, is all these different little events all add up to one big adventure.
Yeah.
Right. We can tell that, you know, like I say, I'm going through my list here of what didn't I ask you yet. Still early days of the trip, realistically. I mean, you got your 650 plus miles through of a 6,000 miles. So still, you're 1/9 of the way through.
Yeah.
You're still excited about doing this trip, right? That's quite evident. So I don't need to ask that question. We have talked over the past year about the risk factor.
Yes.
You've talked about it on a few of our episodes, knowing when to throw in the towel, and that sort of stuff. There's been trips where we've been on, and it's like, I was on a solo canoe trip up north, and the weather turned like to freezing rain which wasn't in the forecast. And if I'd continued, because it did get worse, I would have been in trouble. But I made the conscious decision to turn around and come on out. There's other people that have not thrown in the towel and have paid the price.
So, yeah, so goal-focused that they ignore health concerns, safety concerns. I've come this far, I have to push on. And like people who have gone up at altitude and got altitude sickness and said, no, I've worked very hard to get here, I have to push on. And then they get very sick, some people die from it. And you end up finding a lot of highly motivated people who pass away on Mount Everest, right?
Right.
It's like, well, very highly motivated, but, you know, they didn't make the choice to say, oh, I have to go find shelter, I have to do this or that. So, and we have discussed this on a couple previous of our episodes where people become overly goal-focused and don't really take into account some safety factors that they should, like, hold off for a bit or take a break or whatever.
So, barring a huge injury, barring a 4-foot hole in your boat, or that call from home, do you have a limit? Is there a point that you think to yourself, if it gets this bad, I'm going to call it?
Yeah. My health is important to me to the extent that I will do this so long as I am physically able.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that I would be physically able if I was run down with something really, really extreme. I mean, like, really extreme. So, like, a little history. About a month and a half ago, I got COVID on this trip.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I ended up sitting in the tent for 2 weeks. And it was a very, very long 2 weeks to just be sitting and waiting for, like, sickness to just pass. But with something like that, I know that it would pass eventually and it'd be okay. I ended up getting a lingering fatigue that still persists today, a month and a half later.
Yeah.
And so for the last month and a half, it has really sucked getting here. And I haven't really talked about it at all, but I'm just kind of waiting for that fatigue to go away. If I were to get like a really bad infection or something that would require me to go to the hospital that couldn't be fixed overnight or with antibiotics or anything like that. Like if I lost a finger, that would be pretty good drawing a line. If I lost a limb, if I got attacked by an alligator,
that would be a traumatic.
That would be
a big event.
that's a drawing the line moment. If I ended up having the boat destroyed in a hurricane, that would be a pretty traumatic event. Yeah, I would definitely throw in the towel there. If somebody in the night came to my canoe and robbed me of like two or three of my bags, I would throw in the towel instantly. I mean, like if I lost my
gear, hard to recover from that.
I don't have the money to be able to recoup that. I don't have those. That has taken years to acquire those things. It's everything I own. That'd be like losing a house to me. So I would throw in the towel. If I lost my possessions somehow, if they sank or if they were stolen, I would be so distraught, I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't be able to go any farther.
So there is a limit to, you have your limits, and you as I mean they say up here, know your limits, play within it.
Yeah.
Right. So, but yeah, if you ended up with losing your food bag, for instance, somebody stole it, you're not going to continue on. If you're in an area where you cannot get proper food to, because you need the energy from the food to continue the journey.
It would be the gear, though. Like you can always recoup food. It's equipment. It's all about equipment, I think.
Yeah. If I lost my food, I would still keep going.
Yeah.
You keep on going.
Yeah.
Yeah, just even though I'd spend a long time like dehydrating my own food and stuff, preparing for the expeditions. But this is like, if I lost food, I could recoup my food and get different ones, and I could definitely keep on going. But like, there's equipment in there that's like irreplaceable,
right?
At this point in the voyage, that's just like so far in the depth of like, I just can't imagine being on the expedition without some of the equipment that I have.
Right.
And without, like, it would just take too long to get more. I would have to spend at least a couple years just, like, saving up and trying to build up to that point of being so self-sufficient again. You know, it takes a long time. You know, like, people go out there to Alaska to build cabins, and then some of them, like, have solar panels and things like that, and electricities. And they do that on a quest for self-sufficiency. But it doesn't happen overnight. That doesn't even happen in a year. Those people go out there to build cabins over the span of decades. And they build those cabins, and then they start to build their self-sufficiency around the cabins. And so I spent a very long time trying to acquire the right boat for the expedition. And I spent a long time to acquire the right sponsorships and the right support teams. And then above all that, the right equipment, exactly knowing what I need for every area of the expedition. Like here, for example, I need water filters. I need certain things. Like down in Florida, I need a hammock, for instance, because there's some places where there's no land. Like you'll go to like these mangrove islands and just it's all under the tide. There's specific gear for specific places that I have acquired over a long period of time that's just irreplaceable, in the same way that if somebody were to like have a meteor crash through the roof of their cottage out in Alaska that they've spent 30 years building and getting so self-sufficient, it's like, how do you recover from that? It's going to take a long, long time to recover from something like that. So in short, yeah, I've got very fine lines for throwing in the towel, and I'd say they're pretty reasonable lines. I'd say a lot of people have those same lines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you're going to be on this for quite the while. Are people welcome to join you for some day paddling if they know where you're going to be?
If it's pre-planned, yeah. If I'm like talking with people and they ask to have permission to come out and paddle with me for a day, I would love to have the company and the conversation and talking. I just need to like mentally prepare myself for that.
Right.
Because I plan my days out and I plan everything out very meticulously now. I never used to do that. It's kind of really interesting that I used to be so willy-nilly and just all over
the
place.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. And now I'm finding that I've gotten really good at knowing what's going on. Mm-hmm. Around me and the environment, the weather, whether it be tides, weather, hurricane seasons, time of year, how much time I have to get to certain places. There's a lot to think about, like water supply. How much water do you have? Water quality. Can I filter water here? How much food do you have? How long is this food going to last you? Where are the nearest restocks? Do I need to restock at the next restock point? How much weight am I carrying? And how long do I have to carry this weight for? Am I overpacked? Am I underpacked? When is it going to rain next? I mean, the weather is plays a huge significant role in everything going on. And honestly, the weather is king out here.
Yeah.
If the weather does not permit you to move, you don't move. There's no fighting.
Especially on the Great Lakes and the ocean.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. There's a lot of contingencies in a lot of different areas that you have to think about constantly. Above all that, the areas that you're going through, you have to know where you're going to sleep every night. Are you going to be at a place that you're easily accessible at? Are you going to have to rough camp it? Is it legal to even camp there?
Yeah.
Is there high law enforcement if it isn't legal? You know, I mean, not to say that I've ever camped in places that are illegal.
Yeah, what do they call that? Covert camping? Or there's another word for it.
Stealth camping.
Stealth camping, yeah.
I mean, there was a time on the Mississippi, hypothetically, that...
Hypothetically?
That I had paddled into the night because there was nowhere to sleep. And this is on the recent one where I repaddled. And it was getting dark and it was getting to the point where the rapids were coming up and you could hear the rapids, but you couldn't see them. And I was like, well, this is getting a little bit too dangerous because if I hit a rock this late at night, I flip the boat over, it's just going to really suck. So I ended up stopping and, you know, it was like toe-to-toe with cottages everywhere.
Yeah.
So there was a little splotch of like grass right on the side. It wasn't even mowed. It was so overgrown, but there was a staircase leading down, and up on the top of this cliff was this cabin, and the cabin couldn't see down under the waterfront, but you knew the cabin was up there and there were people up there because you could see the lights on as you were approaching. And I just paddled right up. It's like 10 o'clock at night. took my tent, rolled it out on the little splotch of grass that was like 6 feet long, and it was on an incline of like 45 degrees. So it sucked. And I just rolled my tent out, and I slept in my tent, and I woke up at 5 in the morning and packed up very quietly, got back on the water, and kept going.
They had no idea you were there.
They had no idea I was there. I was the invisible man.
Sometimes that's better. Yeah. Unless, of course, they were offering lunch and breakfast.
Yeah, but that was an emergency situation. Yeah. Like I didn't want to risk anything.
Your website has a live tracker. Again, it's whereispeterfrank.com, so people know whereabouts you are. So
yeah.
If people like me want to yell at you from the top of the lock.
Yeah. Yeah, if you want to stalk me and see where I'm going to be, where I am, I have a live tracker on my website. I keep that up for safety purposes, just so that if anything did happen, people would know where I am. If I ever flipped the boat, if the boat ever went offshore, I always keep myself tethered to the boat while I'm paddling.
Yep.
For safety purposes as well, just in case I ever drowned, I will be found with my boat, which is a natural flotation device. So there's a lot of purposes behind that, but most importantly as well, or not the most importantly, but a big reason is so that you guys can be part of the journeys as well and see where I am every day. I put like a little picture on there.
Yep.
Every day. And that's one of my sponsorships actually is the time and technology put into building my own custom design pirate map. So the live tracker is on its own.
I like that map too.
That was from 060. They do expedition maps for adventurers. Is the best thing ever. It's so funny to have a treasure map.
Yeah, it looks like an old time pirate treasure map. Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah.
The other thing we noticed on your website is, I mean, there's a lot of people say, hey, Can I donate to you or, you know, buy me a coffee sort of deal?
I've seen it where people sell boats and it's like, buy me a beer or buy us a beer.
Yeah.
And you have buy me a chicken.
Yeah, I got that from the Ko-fi thing.
Yeah.
The where people like send $5 to buy me a coffee website. But I didn't want to like do the coffee thing because I'm like, well, I know how to build websites. So I might as well just make my own little thing. So I did buy me a chicken. And so I thought it's funny because it's this universal thing where rotisserie chickens are $4.99 American at Costco everywhere in the United States. So it's like this kind of universal thing that everybody knows the price of a rotisserie chicken. And I figure it's like the perfect price to where people aren't sacrificing too much, but they can sacrifice enough to where it's like, we'll send them $5 for a meal. And it just helps enough to where I can eat every now and then. So it's a...
Every now and then.
Every now and then.
When the fish aren't busy jumping at me.
When the fish aren't busy, yeah. So it's nice. And I can use it for gear or like other things as well. And it's a quirky little thing. So that's what I set up.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So if people want to come out and say, hey, I'm going to be in your area, you're going to be in my area, can I come out and paddle with you for an hour while you're...
Or can I come out and help
you? Or can I come out and help you? How do they get a hold of you?
I have an email on my website.
The website has a contact.
Yeah. I also do social media. I have a Facebook group, which is Peter's Voyage, and I post in my group pretty consistently. And then I have my Instagram, which I prioritize for posts and my writing. And my Instagram is just Captain Peter Frank. And you can find all this on my website, whereispeterfrank.com.
Alrighty.
And that's the best way to reach out for any of inquiries if I'm paddling through your area. I do love to have company. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to say I'm not a filthy pirate, but you just gotta get out here and find out.
Some days you are, some days you aren't.
Yeah.
Sponsors. Who are your sponsors for this trip?
So I have five now. One of them is pretty new. The newest one reached out about a week ago. Jim, good friend of mine, just reached out and told me that he knows a guy out in the UK, Duncan, who owns Oscar Propulsions.
Right.
And so what they're doing is they're creating this design, or they have created this design that they put like these specifically, I don't know how, I'm going to chop this up like horribly. Okay. So don't mind me. I just learned about it a week ago, but I'm going to explain this basically in the way a fifth grader would. There's like these holes in the paddle that are designed by a very smart man.
Duncan Troy.
Duncan Troy. And he put these there because as you make a paddle stroke, the amount of pressure built up from the paddle stroke is relieved with these holes by releasing pressure through the paddle. And I know that you're going to explain this better after I do.
Hang on, where's my phone? Because
they have it on the website. Okay, it's Oscar Propulsion. And so anyway, they reach out to me with this thing. They're like, we got this fantastic invention that we have. We want to send you a couple of paddles. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's great. Because you know I use that wooden single blade. And that single blade, I don't even know how much it weighs. Probably like, it's got like so many, like I wore down the finish on it, so it soaks up water. So practically the whole thing is water weight anyway. But they're sending me a carbon fiber outrigger paddle with the Oscar Propulsions design. And what it's going to do is it's going to alleviate the fatigue that I will experience while I'm paddling because it's releasing so much pressure in each paddle stroke. So that's the aim anyway. So I'll be able to try out this equipment. And it's a great thing because, as I mentioned, I have chronic back pain now for the rest of my life. So doing these trips is like one of the most important things to me in my young life, is being able to do this because I don't know what's going to happen to me 10 years, 20 right. years down the road.
Yeah.
So for me, I feel like I have this internal clock. I have to do this, like now. And I know we talk about like throwing in the towel and this and that, but for me, this is my life. For right now in my young life, this is my life. And so these Oscar Propulsions people sending me this paddle that is theoretically going to alleviate some of this pain and pressure and psychological torment of paddling a paddle stroke 12,000 times every day. It just sounds like a dream come true. And I'm going to get these pretty soon. I'm pretty excited to
get them. Yeah, they used laser cuts on it.
Yeah.
And it came from him designing better propellers yeah. on ships.
Oh, yeah.
To lower the decibel levels and stuff like that. So now he's put it into designs for paddles. The same theory that he puts these little laser cuts into the paddle blades and it's supposed to help things out. So give it a whirl and see if it'll let us know if it works.
I will. Oh, my gosh. Right? It's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, Jim sent me a message about that. Hey, yeah, you should check these out. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
They sound pretty cool.
Yeah, I'll let you know. I'll let you know how they go. Man, it's going to be so much fun.
Tell us about the other sponsors. So that's Oscar Propulsion. Who else is your sponsors?
I've got Red Leaf Designs, which do my custom spray decks. And they also do spray decks for open face canoes as well. So when I do some open face canoe expeditions up in the future, I'm going to have new spray decks built for those. But that's Red Leaf Designs. And then Sawyer sent me some filters to try out, and they've been amazing. I have nothing bad to say about that. And then there's Oscar Propulsions and 060, which are the people that build the custom expedition maps, and they track everything from my Garmin data. So I have like my little GPS tracker,
right?
And it pings into the online map for the Garmin stuff. But let's be honest, the Garmin maps are just like, the Garmin maps suck. I don't like them at all. They're just not. They're not to my liking, not to my taste. So it takes all of that data and it automatically puts this in this external link for this custom map. And the map is completely custom designed. They showed me a bunch of other ones that some people did. They took a AI platform and they, or maybe it was their own AI software, and they ran one person's handwriting, like pages and pages and pages of their handwriting. And they got it down pat to where the technology could write in that person's handwriting.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And they had all of the titles of all of the cities and names and states and everything on their custom map made with their own handwriting because they were a writer.
Yeah.
And then my last sponsorship here that I have is Falcon Sales. I reached out to them because I was interested in their kayak sales. So
right.
they have like these 1.0 square meter sails that are rigged on a carbon fiber mast that mounts directly to your boat.
Yes.
And so they had sent me one, and I rigged it up to my canoe because my I have a decking on my canoe because it's kind of like halfway between a kayak and a canoe. And I've had it for the last 2 months on this trip, and that thing is so much fun.
Right?
I go out, the big waters, it's a little bit difficult in like the bigger open waters because, you know, obviously I go through every season of the year and all the conditions of every weather. But all these streams and inland lakes here in the Trent Severn, I'm not penalized by the big wind waves. So like if I'll get big winds that are like 10, 15 miles an hour, I can cruise off of those really penalty from the waves.
Yeah.
Versus being out there on the big lakes, it's too many waves. But the Falcon Sail, that's amazing. I haven't been in wind yet to be able to sail completely under sail power, but I have I've been pretty much paddling every paddle stroke with the sail up, and it's been honestly an alleviation on my back pain and all of the stress that I put on my shoulders and my muscles.
Right.
And I'm finding that days that I used to push really hard, like a 35-mile day, and then immediately after, like a 20-mile day, like I'm finding that the day after really hard days that I use the sail, even though I'll go the same distance, I won't have any of that pain in the morning. Like I'll be good to go again. Like
okay,
that
makes a big difference.
Reduces a lot of stress. And so you'll find that a lot of my these two sponsors, I mean Oscar Propulsions now and Falcon Sails, their main priority that I am choosing them to be part of the expedition is for the alleviation of pain that I endure on the trip, so that I can do it and have more longevity on the trip.
And if it works for you, then maybe it works for others as well.
That's what I was thinking, right? Too. And there's a lot of people out there that can't do these trips because of disabilities or because of things that are going on in their lives. Like I said, older people, veterans, and people who get to a point in their life where they want to go on this enormous trip and discover themselves later in life, they get to an age where back pain and shoulder pain and muscle joints, aches, arthritis, things like that set in. It's a part of life. We're people. We're human. We're fragile. And having these things and experimenting with these things might be able to help some of those older people.
Sounds like Derek.
I am getting old.
He's getting old. If you listen to some of our podcasts, like, you swear he was 90 the way he talks. He's out there with two canes.
And it amazes me that some of these, like, the who's the older gentleman that just did the Mississippi? He made a record, record time.
That's Graybeard. Dale Sanders. Yeah.
How old is he?
What is he, like 89?
80, yeah. And he's got this thing going with another guy who's just
back and
older.
Forth. They compete with each
other. Keep competing with each other because he's like just older than him.
Yeah.
So then he does it.
Ooh.
Then he's got to go and take the record back. And then he's got to try to.
You want to know the story about that?
Sure.
Do you know it?
Yeah. So he did the river the first time. He was like, say what, 82 or 83 or something.
Yeah.
He set the oldest record he set the record for the oldest person to canoe the Mississippi River. Right. And then Guinness Book of World Records, great thing. And then all of a sudden, you know, you said this guy comes out of nowhere, sets this record. I don't know how old he was, mid 80s. So Graybeard, he's like, this old fart, you know.
That can't be. That can happen.
So he departed on the Mississippi a week before I did my descent. So he was on the river the same time that I was. On his second descent down the river, he was like 87, 88. I can't remember how old he was. But he had his birthday on the water, so we got the record of the next year. And he finished the river in, I think it was 87 days. Yeah, so I think he tried to finish it in the amount of days that how old he was, and that's the only reason why I remember. So he was like 87. And then he finished, and the other guy that was initially beat him the first time, he had passed away.
Oh,
he did pass away.
Yeah.
I didn't know. I didn't hear that part.
I think that was at the end of his film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Graybeard made a film.
I haven't seen the whole thing yet.
I think at the end they put a, because they interviewed him in the film, and at the end they put a
little in memorial
of. A little memorial of him. And that's the only reason why I know.
Huh.
So I,
interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm like 99% sure. That's,
we'll find out.
We'll find out. So please don't quote me on that. But I'm pretty sure that's the...
Papi the pirate said you was dead.
The pirate says you was dead. Okay, so I am deathly sorry if I am wrong for spreading this information. But like I said, I am 99%. I watched the film and I saw the memorial at the end. I'm like, why would they put that in if it was anybody else?
Yeah, you know, right?
It's
exactly.
One of those things. So. We'll see. I got a bunch of people messaging me saying, "Hey,
he's not dead. Wait, when did I die?"
Yeah.
It's
a good film, though. Great beer. Yeah. You know, there's the Last Great River Paddle or something like that. And he's it's like $20 online for the DVD. Really worth the watch.
Is there anything else you want to add to this? What we said today.
Any other shout-outs? Anybody you want to mention?
Let's see. I'll just go over the sponsorship list one more time just because it's all so spread apart. So I got Oscar Propulsions with the paddles, Falcon Sails for the sailing part of the trip, Red Leaf Designs for my spray decks, and Sawyer sent me some water filters, and 060 for my custom pirate map. So those are the five horsemen of the apocalypse.
I still like that pirate map.
That's pretty cool.
I like that.
Yeah, very custom.
Yeah.
So whenever you finish. That sounds so bad all of a sudden.
When you're back to Michigan.
whenever you're finished the loop, I'd love to do a second interview.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we're going to have to listen to this interview first so that we can then on the second one say, you know, how did your views change as you went along?
Yeah.
Did you make any friends with alligators?
Yeah. Do you own an alligator farm now? How much help did you get along the way? And what went according to plan, what did not, and what went even better than expected.
Yeah. So we'll close the loop at the end of your show.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be a good follow-up for sure.
We'll drive down to you.
Like I said, this journey is a journey of self-discovery. Like I keep saying, this is I'm out here to find answers, and I wouldn't be out here if I had any of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm definitely trying to find them myself. And the ironic thing is that when I finish this trip, I don't think I'll have any answers.
or more questions.
We'll have a really good conversation.
Right?
For sure. That's
awesome.
Well, that's awesome. Peter, thank you for coming on.
Yes, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
We're going to be following you along this trip to see how far you make it and whatnot. Hopefully all the way in one go with no alligators. And all your fingers.
Yeah, of course.
Right? That'd be awesome.
Oh, my gosh. It's been a pleasure to be here in this house. This is my first shower in like a week. It's been... Oh, my gosh. You could have seen me on the Georgian Bay. When I got done with that, I hadn't had a shower in like two full weeks. It was like, wow. I was a really filthy pirate when I finished that. And then I finished, and I got to Port Severn, the beginning of the Trent Severn Waterway, and I had my 23rd birthday last week.
Oh,
happy belated
birthday!
Thank you. It's been pretty great. Can't believe I've been circumnavigating this planet for 23 years.
Exactly. Hey, you got a long way. There's a lot. I mean, you look at guys like Frank Wolf. Have you ever seen his maps?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
With all the lines. I mean, he's got the hook lines on a map. Yeah. All these places he goes. And it's just canoe trip after canoe trip after canoe trip after canoe trip after
canoe
trip.
Trips, like big far north.
If you can do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
I'd like to see all that on one map.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's just like a giant, somebody goes nuts with colored crayons on a map.
Yeah. Yeah, you should see my map on the
Zero. I looked at it. Yeah.
It's just like completely filled to the brim. So, not completely filled to the brim, but you know, someday I'd like it to be filled to the brim. But yeah, that's what I'd like to see. Some of these adventures have all of their expeditions. I want, like you said, the people going up there in Canada and doing just like these extensive trips.
Yeah.
Like over and over and over again, 1,000 times. Like they must have like treasure maps built out of like the lines that they do up there. It must be some kind of strategic, you know, map to the stars.
Right.
That's probably why they don't have those maps.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're hiding something.
That's They're right. hiding something. Bodies. They're hiding bodies. P,
Peter, thank you for coming on.
Yes, thank you for sharing your journey, and we look forward to the continuation of your journey.
Thank you guys so much. This has been it's been a pleasure. And what do you say at the end of your, do you have a closing?
Oh, we do.
We do.
You do have a closing. Yeah, all right, let's hear it.
We do. If you want to find more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
Hey, I'm Derek Specht. I'll see you next time.